Next presenter is Sheena Hagman. And Sheena has been studying at York University and has just recently finished her PhD in ethnomusicology and musicology. Congratulations. And her title of her favorite days is No Money, No Problems, The Role of the Remix in Restructuring Compensation for Producers of Electronic Dance.
Thank you for being here this afternoon. The remix, one of the more prominent and ubiquitous innovations of the contemporary music industry, remains largely misunderstood both within and outside music scholarship. Remixes are frequently perceived and characterized as violations of slowly evolving copyright law for the benefit of amateur bedroom producers, who are either lauded as champions for creativity of expression or denigrated as petty thieves who deny original artists their financial due. In fact, the bulk of remixes that reach the public's ear have been composed by professional EDM producers with the permission of the copyright holders, who commission these remixes with the intention of using the new versions as promotional material for the original song and artist. Because remixes are used in this way, the producers of this music often find themselves making financial arrangements with labels that fail to reflect the music industry's new dependence on remixing as a way to promote the artist signed to their labels. In response to the precariousness of their situations, these producers are becoming more resourceful and carving out new ways to trade labor for compensation that reflects their changing role in the music industry, as well as being more fair for these producers. Based on interviews with 29 professional DJs and producers and 13 record label executives, this presentation focuses on the ways in which producers of remixed music are compensated for their work. I'll discuss some of the ways producers of EDM are traditionally paid for their remixes, as well as introducing some of the more innovative solutions to the problem of compensation for music that continues to be considered legally derivative despite the original contributions of remixers. I'll continue by discussing some of the gains being made by remixers with respect to legally protecting their intellectual property, which may be a reflection of changing attitudes towards derivativeness in music. To conclude, I'll offer some opinions about what record labels could be doing to ensure that remixers are fairly compensated for their labor. According to my respondents, compensation for remixes and remix analogs, what I've called remix analogs, that is, such as mashups and bootlegs, can be delineated into three broad categories. First is what I've called direct compensation, which is characterized by an agreement between the remixing producer and the copyright holder that results in some kind of monetary payment to the remixing producer for services rendered. Many also cited receiving indirect compensation for their remixes, which was most commonly linked to being hired for gigs on the basis of a producer's remixes. I've called this type of compensation indirect because the producers who are hired for gigs on the strength of their remixes understand this to be a form of compensation for the work that they do in the studio. And these producers who reported being compensated indirectly tended to create remix analogs, such as mashups and bootlegs, without the permission of the source material's copyright holder. And finally, it was common for producers to report receiving no payment at all for their remix work, sometimes even in instances where they were contracted to make remixes by record labels. Knowing the different ways that producers can be compensated or not for their remixes, the question of how money drives the decision to make remixes should be considered. As might be expected, younger producers, that is, those who are at the start of their careers and are working to break into the scene, were generally less concerned about being paid for their remixes, especially if there was any chance that making a remix for free in the present might lead to bigger things down the road. For example, remix contests hosted by blogs, labels, and artists were mentioned as instances in which composing a remix for free might lead to being noticed by a famous producer or important label, who would then be in a position to offer institutional support for future song production activities. On the other hand, more seasoned professional producers tend to be concerned with the building and maintenance of a standard of living that allows them to make music full-time, and thus are more likely to base decisions about which songs to remix on the amount of money and or type of compensation package. Famous professional producers, for example, are more likely to weigh the amount of money offered by a label against the number of hours it might take to create a remix, which would then influence their decision-making process. However, it should be acknowledged that there are far more non-famous professional producers than there are famous ones, and many producers without international fame articulated a willingness to accept any commission for a remix as long as it was accompanied by an offer of money. For a majority of producers who are compensated directly, payment comes in the form of a lump sum amount that tends to be determined by factors such as a producer's relative fame, the length of time a producer has been involved in the industry as a professional, and the budget of the record label or original artist requesting the work. For example, lesser-known producers reported earning as little as $50 for a remix commissioned by an indie artist and up to $1,500 for a remix requested by a major label. By contrast, producers with long careers and international fame can command between $3,000 and $5,000 per remix, depending on the label's budget. Despite the broad range of compensation, many producers stated that the amount of this flat fee is often not enough to justify the time and effort required to make a remix. Though accepting any amount of money, no matter how small, to make remixes seems to contradict the professional producer's goal of maintaining enough financial autonomy to focus on making music full-time, the financial reality of the contemporary music industry makes it very unlikely that an unknown, untested producer will interest a label enough to earn big money for his remixes, despite his talent. Not only is there an influx of producers who have increasingly easy access to the tools of song production and the ability to widely distribute their music over the internet without the help of or support of the record label, there's also a growing culture of consumers who are increasingly resistant to the idea of paying for music that they want to listen to, which has led to a music industry that is not making as much money as it did prior to the digitization of music distribution. As such, the going rate of payment for remixes has decreased dramatically because there are more people, particularly young, aspiring producers, who are willing to work for free and thus are less concerned with recouping the costs, such as time and money, that are associated with creating a remix. Even when producers are not keen to distribute their music without charge, torrent sites, like the Pirate Bay, for example, are very effective at helping audiences to circumvent the requirement that they pay for what they consume. As a result of this complex financial conundrum, producers are coming up with more circuitous and indirect ways to profit from their remixes. Many producers mentioned creating bootlegs and mashups for personal use, which are then featured on mixtapes that they send to club promoters. These producers would then be hired for gigs on the basis of their ability to refashion familiar, popular songs in novel ways. For example, Toronto-based DJ and producer Vivi Diamond is well known for her live and recorded mashups. Though the vast majority of her derivative songs are created from music she has not been granted permission to use, she maintains that the time and effort she invests in making bootleg remixes is eventually repaid because her work makes her attractive to club promoters who will hire her for gigs based on her production work. To put it plainly, Vivi Diamond and others like her have found a way to profit from their derivative compositions without requiring the institutional support of record labels. Now, because of a lack of money in the music industry, many producers have also begun to replace the minimal financial compensation currently being offered with what is essentially a barter system by participating in something called a remix swap. Remix swapping is exactly what it sounds like. An exchange of labor between producers who make remixes of each other's original songs. And this method of compensation was frequently mentioned as one way to commission a remix without offering money, but in a manner that's fair to all parties. Remix swaps are also now being encouraged by smaller EDM labels, who view them as a prudent cost-saving measure in an era when music sales are lower than ever. Though producers have certainly taken matters into their own hands with respect to using remix production to earn gigs or exchange labor through remix swapping, it remains far too common for remixers to be exploited by record labels via the speculative contract. To be hired on spec, as producers call it, means that a remix is created under contract to record labels, but with no guarantee of payment whatsoever. A remix commissioned on spec may never be released, and if it is released, the producer will only be paid if the remix sells. While this on its face may seem standard enough, the fact that many commissioned remixes are distributed to audiences as free promotional material means that the remixer is unlikely to see any financial return on their work. The nature of the speculative contracts offered to remixers differ somewhat from the speculative nature of some publishing and licensing contracts offered to producers for their original music. While the release of original songs is guaranteed to earn income for producers once the song begins to sell, there is no guarantee that a remix commissioned on spec will ever be released by a label, or if released as free, that it will ever make any money. And when remixes are not released, the speculative contract usually stipulates that the remixer forfeits any right to release the song through another label or platform. As a best case scenario, the remixer may be able to use the song privately as part of a set in a gig or in a mixtape, but any broader distribution of the song can result in legal action brought by the label. And as a result, it's common for producers to be deterred from making remixes for labels after a negative experience working under a speculative contract. Despite the financially precarious nature of the speculative contract, remix swapping, indirect forms of compensation, and lump sum payments that fail to accurately reflect the labor of remix production, there is reason to be cautiously optimistic that things are changing for the better. Though still uncommon on a larger scale, a small number of producers reported being able to negotiate contracts that include a percentage of publishing and licensing rights that will earn royalty payments for the remixer, often in addition to a pre-negotiated flat fee. These type of arrangements, which resemble the contracts offered to labels, offered by labels, that is, for the production of original songs, are more easily obtained by producers who have been active in professional EDM production for a longer period of time. Juan McLean, for example, reported negotiating contracts for payments that include publishing and licensing rights for up to 50% of the remix's total profits, based in large part on his long career and a high demand for his work. Though I want to stress again that publishing and licensing contracts remain rare and tend only to be offered to producers with established careers and fan bases, the fact that such contracts are offered at all may suggest that record labels are beginning to acknowledge that producers contribute original musical ideas to their remixes, and that remixed music is ostensibly an asynchronous collaboration between two parties who each bring something new and original to the table. Additionally, anecdotal evidence suggests that the law may be beginning to favor claims of originality in remixing, albeit slowly and with many false starts. When I was conducting my fieldwork, I learned of a lawsuit between a highly respected producer of electronic music and a popular indie band from one of my informants. The band had commissioned a remix from the producer, and though the producer attempted to get the band to sign a publishing and licensing contract, the band refused, and an agreement was never reached. Shortly afterwards, the remix was licensed for use in a car commercial, and because the band quietly ignored the producer's request for a fair financial agreement, the band collected all the royalties while the producer got nothing. The lawsuit, launched in the UK, argued that it was the producer's original contributions to the remix and not the source material that made the song attractive for use in the car commercial, and the lawsuit was eventually settled out of court in favor of the producer. The settlement also included a non-disclosure clause, which is why I haven't identified the producer, the band, or the commercial in my presentation, despite having had this information confirmed for me by the producer who launched the lawsuit. This anecdote illustrates some of the gains being made by remixers in protecting their interests, while also demonstrating that there's a long way to go before such cases become the norm. The lawsuit being settled in favor of the remixer should send the message that remixes can meet the legal standard of originality applied to non-derivative works, but the non-disclosure clause also ensures that no one can learn the details of this case, and no legal precedent for supporting a remixer's claim to ownership over original contributions to a derivative work can be referred to in the future. Now, not being a legal scholar, I'm hard-pressed to know what the right answer to the question of fairly compensating producers for their remixes should be. But a partial solution, I would suggest, would be for record labels to treat remix songs the same way they treat original tracks, as commodities to be sold to customers. All 13 record label executives I interviewed stated that the primary purpose of the remix within their business model is to promote new releases of the artists that are signed to their labels. And in promotion of these new releases, remixes are treated as disposable and interchangeable commodities that are given away for free in the sometimes vain hope that a listener who encounters the remix first will be as or more interested in the original version that sounds markedly different from the remix that first captured their attention. However, there was no real consensus regarding whether or not remixes are more effective as promotional material for the original song or more valuable to the remixers themselves. For example, Udi Radomski, the head of the London-based labels Low and Loaf Recordings, notes that remixes account for less than 1% of his label's sales and are only useful as promotional material. By contrast, Barbie Castelvi of the Toronto-based label Intelligenics sees a strong connection between the sales of remixes and interest in the remixing producer's other work. Again, the key difference here is how remixes are treated by the record labels. If a remix is first distributed for free in order to drive interest in and sales of the original song and is later sold alongside the original song, it stands to reason that sales of the remix would be markedly diminished compared to sales of the original song. Labels that treat the remix as something to be sold alongside the original from the outset, however, tended to observe consumption habits that included both an interest in the original song and an interest in the remixing producer's other work. The purpose of this talk has been to shed light on ways in which producers of electronic dance music are compensated for their remixes. Though money was only one on a long list of motivations behind creating remix music, it will come as no surprise that financial matters significantly influence how and why electronic dance music producers make this music. The question of appropriate compensation for remix music is an especially interesting one, given the extent to which both the funding and dissemination of electronic music within contemporary culture are driven by technological advances that make it easier than ever before to both make and steal music. Moreover, the blurry legal space occupied by remixing makes it easier to exploit the labor of producers who are seeking to gain a foothold in the saturated EDM market or simply make a decent living. It's difficult to tell what the future holds for remixing as a part of the music industry, but there are encouraging signs that seem to point towards a greater acceptance of derivativeness as an important component of contemporary music expression. And the use of remixed music by record labels serves as a reminder of how derivative works have been valued in the recent past, as well as how showing, how such appraisals may be changing. Thank you.
Thank you, that was really interesting. A question that I wonder if any of you had any response, because the tricky thing with a remix is that it seems like there's always the balance between, you know, is it how recognizable the original is it? Mm-hmm. Certainly, I've heard remixes of like, it's the same track, or like, it almost seems like, it's like trying together is a lot of work to make it actually seem like. The one for remixing together is like a completely new track with like some vague reference to it. But did you find that that was part of the negotiation? Like how far some of the remixers could push it, or was that ever an issue in terms of the negotiation, in terms of these remix deals?
I wasn't made privy to much of the detail of how these negotiations go on, but my general understanding of it, especially from producers whose careers are 5 years old or less, is that if they offer you a contract, you just take it and there's not much negotiation. But once you become more famous, like Juan McLean, for example, I bring him up a lot in my dissertation because he had many interesting things to say. He's also been a professional musician in this scene for about 15 years, and he's well known around the world. So he has an agent, and it's much more easy for him to negotiate the terms of his contract because there's such a high demand for his work. So I think there is definitely a relationship between how much in demand you are as a producer. I couldn't say for sure whether or not the content of the song is negotiated in advance, especially because it's difficult. More often than not, these contracts are not offered for remixes that have been pre-created, because you have to somehow get your hands on the source material. And if you're going to be paid for the remix, then you have to acquire the source material from the source rather than from someone else. So I'm not sure if that answers your question.
Mm-hmm. And it seems like sometimes it's not. It's very, very hidden. It's something you really have to work at to even like figure out. Okay, which has its own appeal, but it seems often to kind of be frustrated that tension is the label.
And this was something that confused me, frankly, in talking to these labels, because the fact is, like, I listened to a lot of remixes over the last several years, a lot of the official remixes that are released as part of an EP in promotion of a new song or an artist that they're trying to break sound nothing like the songs that they're in promotion of. And in talking to one label head mentioned that the idea is to appeal to as many different musical tastes as possible, because the idea of depleting $1 million into just one style of music that you have no idea if it's going to sell or not is a really bad idea from a business standpoint. So you want to spread your net as widely as possible by making as many different versions of the song that sound different enough that you will potentially draw in listeners. But of course, if you're not selling the song, that means you're not tracking the sales. And if there's no connection between the remixing producer and your record label, it's difficult to know not only how effective that remix will be in directing people's focus back to the original song, but also how the remix might drive interest in the remixer's work at a later time. And this is one of the things that I studied in my dissertation. I call this reordered listening, when you hear a remix prior to hearing the original version of the song and what effect that might have on how you make future consumption choices. And what I found is actually a majority of the people that I interviewed said that they would be more likely to seek out the remixing artist's other work if they heard a remix that they enjoyed before they would consider seeking out the original song. And the general idea is because the remixer's sound is what is most apparent in that remix that you've heard, and it shapes your future experiences with every other version of that song. So it doesn't seem to me like the best model, but of course I can't say that to them because I need them to give me their responses, so.
Back, you have a lot of nuances for the moment. So I just have two questions that are short and related. One's more common, and then you already touched on this, but I've been noticing remixing is changing with the changing technology. So now, like, time stretching is a process which is a much, there are much less artifacts that you get from, like, taking Rihanna and slowing her down and speeding her up or whatever. So you can take the same vocal, which is very recognizable, and layer it over 90 BPM, 120 BPM, and it still works. So I wonder if that's happening in-house, or meaning that the remix artists are maybe being engaged with a part of like the studio team, which whenever we do the Rihanna track, we've got their sixth version, and they're covering all genres, and thereby managing to accumulate that much more money. Almost like, it's not so much you're trying to redirect people to one original version, it's just having this blank effect of everything happening at the same time. I think that's a common question for some of us. But, and then the second thing is very quick, I hope, but you mentioned that you interviewed 29 of the professional
yes.
So I just wonder how that title of professional was applied in terms of your research.
So to acquire my sample, I used a method called snowball sampling, where I started with the artists that I knew and I liked, and I sent them emails. And then I asked them to send the information about my project to their colleagues, who would then hopefully be interested in talking to me. So as far as the definition of professional producer, a DJ is just someone who has received some form of payment at some time for their work related to either spinning in clubs or making music in an electronic milieu. So that's a very broad definition of professional. With respect to your first comment, though, I'd like to address that just because this was a common problem when I was researching my work, and it relates to the definition of remix. And this seems to be very confusing for people, and it's a very murky thing. So I took great care to define this very clearly in my work. So a remix is defined, which I'm sure you know and will agree with, a remix is defined as the use of pre-recorded musical material in combination with newly composed musical material to create a new song. So what you're describing with respect to time stretching may not be necessarily a remix, but it might be a re-edit, which is a song that is composed by reshaping the musical elements present in the existing song, but not adding any new musical material. So yes, that's one way, of course, to create interest. That would be something that I would call a remix analog, like a remix, but not exactly like a remix. Yeah.
This is an interesting presentation about commercial complications. I'm wondering did you recall situations where the artistic relationship or may have been complicated by commerce, in particular cases where the remix relationship may be seen as more collaboration at first than a commercial relationship, you know, as peers working music together and then having to bring commerce and actors back and complicated things. You know, committed issues you describe the cases of somebody making a contract in advance and hiring the DJ to do something, cases where it started more as a genuine artistic collaboration than added a commercial element afterwards.
Oh, certainly that happens all the time, of course. And in fact, the lawsuit anecdote I told you, I'm pretty sure that was exactly the case, that these two people, as I understand it, were friends before they before the one person started reaping all the financial benefit from the other person's work. So this was absolutely a case of a collaboration. It may even have been a remix swap. I couldn't tell you for sure because, again, I'm not privy to the details. I only know just the basic outline of the story. So yeah, that sort of thing, it certainly does happen all the time. In the case of remixes, if it's not a remix swap, they'll almost certainly come to some sort of equitable financial relationship beforehand. And then in other cases, it's just a matter of like, this is the person I collaborate with. We make music together. I remix his stuff. He remixes my stuff, and this is our working relationship. There's a ton of that going on in electronic music today.
About maybe having the mix as an opportunity to market the music towards different demographics. Because, especially if the label sold publishing, and then that would definitely be an incentive.
Yes.
The other thing was more a question. I was wondering if you've explored how it ties into live performance. Because definitely, a lot of these producers will be also DJing and actually maybe making the most of their earnings that way around. So there could be some kind of mutuality, and they gain access to musical material, which they can remix to make a name, but they don't actually need to make money that way because they make money as DJs.
That's a complicated question. Well, I should say first of all that my main focus was on recorded music, so I didn't turn really much of my attention at all to how the live relationship might come into play. And I think you're right that a lot of DJs and producers do probably make more money from their DJing than they do from their song production, because when they are able to negotiate contracts for publishing and licensing, or if the speculative contract somehow does come through and give them money back, it's not a whole lot of money. So yes, they would be making the bulk of their money, a DJ described to me as his bread and butter. However, there is also far less money going to professional DJs now than there used to be, again, because the market is saturated with young guns who are, you know, willing to DJ for drink tickets and a couple of girls at the bar. Quite literally, I've seen this happen. And the quality of the music doesn't matter, because any sort of loud, dancey style music is likely to draw people into the club anyway. So when a real professional comes and offers their services, they generally now start have to lowballing their fee, unless, of course, they have some sort of reputation that precedes them. I'm not sure if that answers your question. Okay.
That you probably would say something like there is not only this compensation issue, but there's also moral economy around the remix.
Yes.
And the people affected, I guess this happens in all different kinds of business teams and I've experienced it elsewhere, but it seems like the people affected, it's hard to get them to separate. When they talk about fairness and all that, is this about money or is it about
Yeah. I think that, older producers who have observed changes over the scene for a longer period of time, for example, Håkan Lidbo, who I quoted here, has been producing music since 1988 professionally, and he has seen these sort of remarkable changes. So his response is to pull himself out of the financial economy altogether and just do remix swapping when he has to do remixes, because he perceives that as being more fair in the sense that he's not being exploited and the original artist is not also being sort of exploited by the record label. Often when you're signed with a label, I don't think you get that much control over the financial matters. I had another point that I wanted to add to that, and I forget what it is now. I'm sorry, maybe we can talk about it afterwards. Sorry about that.
We'll keep that down.
Okay, thank you.